Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. More than 1,000 protesters gathered on the steps of the state capitol last week, calling for an end to Governor Tom Wolf's stay-at-home and business shutdowns designed to slow the spread of the COVID-19 coronavirus. Many were there because they've lost jobs or businesses, and the restrictions were hurting them financially. Some held up signs and banners supporting President Trump or calling the restrictions government tyranny. But there were some who carried guns, including semi-automatic AR-15s. Former Pennsylvania Governor, U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security, and Vietnam combat veteran Tom Ridge spoke out this week about a segment of the protesters in an op-ed in USA Today. Governor Ridge, welcome to the program.
Well, it's nice to join you. I'm sorry we've got to join you under the unprecedented challenges of this country, but Frankly, I'm pleased to have the opportunity to have the conversation with you.
Well, thank you. What prompted you to speak out about these protests?
Well, what is troubling to me is not the fact that they're protests. That's First Amendment. And veterans for a couple hundred years have been fighting for the right to do that. But the whole notion that some, not all, but some of them probably portray themselves as some kinds of heroes. And they're not. This is a time where we need to do what veterans have always done, and that is look out for one another. This is a time for self-sacrifice. This is a time to remind ourselves that we're in this together, and unless we work together, we won't work our way out of this. And so it really irritated me, not the men and women who are struggling economically, psychologically. Look, there's a tremendous amount of economic pressure, but you show up with an automatic weapon at the side and you freedom to carry it. That's too far for me. That is ignoring the reality of our situation. And frankly, it flies in the face of my enormous respect for the veterans community. They're not about self-sacrifice. They're about self. And now's not the time to be about self. This is about saving Americans, not giving your own ego an opportunity to ventilate.
I want to read a segment of your column to you and get your thoughts on this. You wrote that the entire country is under siege, but you are not in the trenches of France, not gaining ground inch by inch in the Pacific, not slogging through the paddies and jungles in Vietnam, and not taking on global terrorists in desert warfare. And you are not prisoners of war. You are at home. Now, you just said that it irritated you. Who were the people that you thought were comparing themselves to those in danger who put their lives on the line fighting for this country?
Well, when you show up in a public forum with an automatic weapon and kind of position yourself somehow as a defender of whatever, that you're there to liberate whatever, that you're there to advance whatever it is that's important to you. Look, everybody wants to go back to work. Everybody wants to return to normalcy. But the whole notion that you come in armed in order to accomplish your goal, this is a democracy. This is the United States of America. We don't formulate and execute public policy at the point of a gun. And to show up and try to intimidate, and what really irritated me are some of the visuals when they're actually confronting the men and women of healthcare, the heroes and the heroines that are dealing with a contagion 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I mean, I think it's a pretty gutless enterprise to show up with a firearm and confront the men and women who are actually in harm's way. They're not in harm's way. The nurses and the doctors are, the EMT professionals, the clerks in the store, the pharmacists, they're in harm's way, and they're doing it without weapons. So you could tell I was a little irritated.
Yeah, I could tell that you were a little bit angry with that. One of our reporters who covered the protest in Harrisburg last Monday talked with one of the protesters who was armed and asked that protester whether the gun, and it was an AR-15, was loaded.
Yep.
And the response was, yes, I have one in the chamber. So, I think a lot of people were wondering what that has to do with stay at home and, reopening the economy.
The simple answer, it has absolutely nothing to do with staying at home. It has nothing to do with supporting your fellow citizens at time of crisis. It has nothing to do with making sure that we're safer tomorrow. It has nothing to do with the spirit of community and that notion of resiliency that we've demonstrated time and time again in the history of this country. As you note in my remarks, I remind everybody, and I remind these protesters, and I'm sure there's some of those that showed up are just frustrated. They've got it. They're out of work. Maybe they're just holding on. But you don't show up with weapons. You're allowed to protest. It's First Amendment. But if you take a look at the history books, we need to remind ourselves we're a darn resilient country, and we prevail when we work together. So let's, as I said, politics be damned. It's no time for it now. We don't formulate public policy at the point of a gun. Let's talk about supporting one another. We're going to work our way out of this. And you know what? We'll work our way out of it quicker if we work together.
But many of the protesters said the restrictions on, you know, for stay at home and for business shutdowns, that kind of thing, that it was government tyranny and that government had overstepped their bounds. And if I was to take that thinking one step further, my guess would be that they would say that if you take away one constitutional right, you're going to take away another, that possibly firearms. Second Amendment is another constitutional amendment that they would see government trampling on. What do you say to that?
I think it's delusional. It's a stretch. And nobody's taking away their firearms. The Second Amendment's got a strong support nationwide. The bottom line is that for whatever reason, these individuals were fired up to protest inconvenience, dissatisfaction, frustration. You know, as I remind everyone in the article, and you were kind enough to refer to it, you know, my good friend John McCain and his colleagues were in the Hanoi Hilton, not for weeks, not for months, but for years and years and years. And all we're doing right now is just saying to each other, let's be smart, let's be safe. Let's stay in our homes where we've got the TV and you got the internet, you got the refrigerator, and you can walk outside and carefully go to the grocery store. So let's, and that's for a couple months. That's all we're asking. And it just seems to me that in the war against COVID-19, and it is a war, it's a war against Mother Nature. She's smart, she's adaptable, and she's relentless. Everybody's wearing the uniform. It's not just a traditional uniform. Everybody's wearing the uniform. It's red, white, and blue, and we got to protect each other, and we got to save each other. You know, you ask any veteran, and they'll tell you they worked with African Americans and Hispanic Americans and Asian Americans, and they didn't particularly pay attention to what their religious beliefs were, their political beliefs were. But in the midst of the challenges that they confronted, they covered each other's back. That's what we should be doing, protecting one another. We'll get through this.
Governor, you served as an infantry staff sergeant in Vietnam, and you earned a Bronze Star for valor. But, you know, throughout your time as governor and as Homeland Security Secretary, you didn't talk about your service very much. But this seems to have really struck a chord with you as a veteran.
Yes, sir, it does. Well, I will tell you, I would say this for most veterans, and of all the public service opportunities I've had, there's nothing of which I'm more proud as to have been a veteran. But I will tell you, most veterans don't dwell on it, but they draw from it. And it just, I took a look, I read the articles, watched a couple of programs, and I said, this is beyond the pale. This is not who we are as Americans. This is not how we help each other get through the many crises this country has confronted. And it was just gave me a perspective. Particularly when I thought of the veterans, when I thought of and I've known many POWs from Vietnam, and I was fortunate not to be one of them. It's just everybody needs to exhale, and we need to protect one another. Our rights will be protected, but we need to remind ourselves in this democracy, you don't show up with loaded firearms in protest. You can make a changes down the road, perhaps. Right now, this is a national crisis. Actually, it's international in nature, but I just... Again, as I said before, I don't dwell on it a lot, but I do draw from it from time to time. And these particular set of circumstances reminded me why I was so proud of my service, but so proud of the and grateful that we live in a country where millions and millions of men and women have served. And I dare say there probably weren't too many veterans walking around the Capitol with a loaded AR-15.
And it happened again happened again yesterday in Michigan as well. Now, as you said yourself, Governor, we know that there are many people who are hurting financially and actually maybe suffering.
Absolutely.
What recourse do they have to protest government actions?
Well, listen, I think, again, I'm a strong believer in the First Amendment, and I realize the frustration is one thing, but I've got to believe, and I haven't heard too many politicians talking about the stress related, financial stress related to people and families who live at the margins to begin with and now are unemployed and furloughed. And they got to be worried about the next meal on the table. Maybe they've got to use a car payment, probably a used car payment they got to make. So we've got to figure out a way in terms of public policy to help these people out, but you don't do it. I mean, you have those discussions and you engage your political leaders, but you don't expect them to do it at gunpoint. That's just not how we operate in the United States of America.
Governor Ridge, I want to change gears for just a moment. You warned that the U.S. may not be ready for a pandemic at least 2 years ago. I remember a column in the Washington Post. What did you see then, and how much of what you were warning about has come to fruition?
Well, about 6 years ago, and I emphasize 6 years ago, a bipartisan group, I know that's not a word that people throw around these days, a bipartisan group co-chaired by my friend, former Senator Joe Lieberman, and yours truly, began looking at biodefense issues, whether or not the antagonist was a nation state that's playing around with bioweapons, or we know the terrorists played around with bioweapons, but Mother Nature's pretty aggressive and focused as well. So we began looking at how prepared we were as a country for a contagion, whether it came at us from a nation state, a terrorist, or Mother Nature. And we decided, for a lot of reasons, we just weren't prepared. There was no strategy. There was no focus. We weren't working with the private sector. So we laid out a series of recommendations. And candidly, we're not in a position to say we told you so, but there were gaps. And one of the learnings, perhaps, once we get by COVID-19, is that the Congress will go back, because we've been working it for 5 years, take a look at some of the recommendations and take the threat of global disease more seriously than they've ever taken it before. We talk about globalization of transportation, globalization of finance, globalization of communication. Now we've learned globalization of disease, and we weren't ready for it. I'm not saying we could have avoided it, but we would have been a lot better prepared had they taken up some of those recommendations a long time ago.
So many of the things that we've seen over the past 2 or 3 months here in the United States, were those actually specific things that your committee warned about?
Well, we thought it was serious enough that it ought to be focused, the overview of this whole effort going forward permanently was the vice president. We thought it was serious enough for there to be a national strategy. And that is one recommendation. I give the Congress and the president credit. That is one recommendation they built out. But there's no unified budget. You know, we're spending billions of dollars on biodefense. And yet I couldn't tell you there's no single document in Washington, D.C. that says where all your tax dollars and my tax dollars and everybody else's money is going to prepare for an event such as this. And it also had to do with research and development, building out medical countermeasures. There's a pretty robust analysis of the gaps, but also, I think, a very constructive list of recommendations that perhaps going forward, given the globalization of disease, the Congress and future presidents will be more inclined to embed into our system of healthcare and government.
You made a point of saying this was 6 years ago. So are you saying both the Obama administration and Trump administration were not prepared?
No, I'm going to say that, like anything else, remember, I spent a great deal of time in public service, and we move slowly through a variety of recommendations. and it was a very thoughtful, reflective action. We started 6 years ago, I think, toward the end of President Obama's administration. We sent the recommendations up to the Hill. Since that time, two or three of the almost three dozen recommendations. So, you know, government moves at glacial-like speed. But what it says, it's not a criticism of any administration. What it says is that American politics, and I'm proud to have served in the political world and world of government, we don't look over the horizon very often. Democracies are much more inclined to be reactive rather than preemptive. And so what I'm saying is that Congress's R's and D's looked at some of the recommendations. Everybody nodded their head. That's a good report. We might do some of these things. But because we asked them to take action today in anticipation of an event that might happen 5 or 10 years down the road, we haven't historically worked that way. And I'm just saying to you that perhaps one of the lessons, positive lessons, post-COVID-19 is that not just in this area, but we may expect our elected officials to look over the horizon, perhaps be better prepared for some of these eventualities rather than respond to them after they occur.
So, Governor Ridge, my final question here, how do we come out of this? I mean, as the nation's first Homeland Security Secretary, I mean, you dealt with this on a regular basis. How do you think we come out of this?
Well, I believe, and I truly believe this, notwithstanding the protesters and my disappointment in their activity, I think what we've seen in community after community throughout this entire country is neighbor helping neighbor. I mean, there's some gaps. There's some people out there that are lonely and some people that really aren't quite getting the support that they need. But it's really rather remarkable what we're trying to do to support one another. I think we come out of this, I'd like to think we come out better, stronger, hopefully inclined to be better prepared. There'll be innovation out of this. There'll be technologies and decisions regard to upgrading our healthcare system. But I'd like to think, once again, as we take a look at the history of the country, we'll prove to ourselves that we're resilient when we act together and prepared just momentarily for those days, months, or weeks of self-sacrifice and taking care of another. I'm an optimist by nature. I trust in America's future, and I trust in Americans who have, over the past couple months, done everything they can to help one another.
Tom Ridge was the 43rd governor of Pennsylvania and first U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security. Governor Ridge, thank you very much for being with us today.
Best wishes to you and your audience. Stay well. We'll get through this.
Thank you, Governor. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. More than half of Pennsylvania's COVID-19 deaths have occurred in nursing homes or other long-term care facilities. The deaths of the state's most vulnerable has raised alarms, but there are still those who say more has to be done to protect residents and staffers at these facilities. Joining us now is the president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Healthcare Association, Zachary Schamberg. Zach Schamberg, welcome to the program.
Scott, good morning. Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Zach, New York has been called the epicenter for COVID-19 geographically. It would seem that nursing homes and long-term care facilities across the country are ground zero for the disease, especially when it comes to deaths in this country. Is that an accurate description?
I think that's exactly right. And, you know, you called New York geographically the epicenter of COVID-19 across the country. I look at Pennsylvania, where 62% of the deaths statewide have occurred in our long-term care facilities. So I'd agree 100%. And, you know, it's something that we've been sharing both publicly and with state government over the course of the last few weeks. And really, even before the epidemic began in Pennsylvania, we knew that long-term care facilities, and that's nursing homes, personal care homes, and assisted living residences, would be the hardest hit in this epidemic. And, you know, I look again at those numbers, at the sheer numbers happening statewide. If 62% of the deaths are occurring in long-term care, why are providers receiving 0% of the support from state government?
Yeah, you just brought up so many points that I want to touch on. I received an email a week or so ago from someone in a long-term care facility, assisted living actually, that was saying they had gotten nothing, no PPEs, nothing from government anywhere else, probably because they didn't have a case. So talk about that. You know, who is getting the equipment when it comes to these facilities?
Well, it's a great question. And, you know, I was on your show. I checked March 16th, which, by the way, feels like about 3 years ago now.
I know.
And, you know, we talked about the things that we were seeing from Washington State, whereas you and your viewers may recall, or your listeners may recall, that was where the first cases, reported cases of COVID-19 occurred, and it was in a nursing home in Washington State. So as we were talking to Washington State, we said, what do we need to be ready for here in Pennsylvania? And one of the first things they said after staffing and after priority testing was, you are going to run out and your providers are going to run out of personal protective equipment. That's masks, gowns, gloves, and goggles. You need to work with your state to make sure that you're adequately supplied. And I think initially the plan was, if you're a facility that has a positive case, we'll send out what's called a quick response team or a QRT to help you. And we'll get you the PPE, we'll get you the staffing aid, we'll get you everything that you need. Well, that was mid-March. A week later, those QRTs were disbanded because the numbers of cases were rising so rapidly. And frankly, I don't think the preparation was there to ensure that we had the necessary supplies. And, you know, now I hate to say it, and I think the listener who sent you that email said it perfectly, you know, it's every provider for themselves. I know providers are reaching out to other states, to manufacturers in other countries. I hate to say it, but there are providers who we've heard, you know, they have frontline workers wrapping themselves in aluminum foil and saran wrap and wearing coffee filters as masks. You know, we're working as an association with Harrisburg University, and it's a pretty incredible partnership. They are 3D printing face shields for our workers. And while that's an incredible partnership and it's a great step in the right direction, it shouldn't have come to that, Scott. We should have been prepared with this PPE.
Okay, now wait a minute. I have to go back to what you were just describing. Wrapping themselves in aluminum foil? I mean, where's that occurring?
So we've heard of facilities not just in Pennsylvania, but nationwide, where providers are going to these lengths to protect themselves. I mean, if you're walking into a facility where there's simply no personal protective equipment, what else are you supposed to do? You know, right now there's a real shortage nationwide of gowns, and you've probably seen stories where frontline workers are being forced to wear ponchos, rain ponchos, or ponchos that you'd get at a Major League Baseball game. Again, I'm not saying that that's right. That's not approved. There's no guideline that says you should be doing that. But frontline workers are having to go to those lengths to protect themselves.
That's scandalous. I mean, that's just unbelievable in this day and age.
Yeah.
Granted, I know that so much of this happened so fast that it was tough to keep up with. But when we're talking about the most vulnerable people, where there have been the majority of deaths, that just is unacceptable. Zach, describe what the Pennsylvania facilities are doing to keep residents safe and their staff safe. I mean, you just touched on what they're trying to do to keep their staff safe, but what about residents?
Well, so when I was on your show on March 16th, we talked about some of the infection control protocols that were already being implemented across long-term care facilities in the state of Pennsylvania. So, you know, all visitation has been banned for all non-essential healthcare visitors. Exceptions are being made for visitors in end-of-life scenarios or hospice scenarios. facilities are using alternative means of communication so that residents are able to communicate with their family members. We are seeing providers screen staff at the beginning of every shift to ensure that they're meeting the requirements for safe entry. All providers and frontline workers are now required to wear masks if they can get them. We've put an end to communal dining and group activities. You know, facilities are now instituting what's called cohorting or creating COVID-positive wings, floors, and, or maybe if it comes to this, even entire facilities, so that we can try to keep the virus concentrated in one area. But the real challenge of this, Scott, is that, you know, as we're learning more about the virus, and again, we talked about this over a month ago. So we look at long-term care. We know that long-term care represents our most vulnerable population, and that's senior citizens who are requiring around-the-clock care. They often have comorbidities and underlying conditions. And we still know so little about this virus, but what we're learning is that you can carry this virus yet be totally asymptomatic. So you've got staff coming in and out of facilities every day by no fault of their own who may be carrying this virus but exhibiting no symptoms. And, you know, that'll, I hope we're able to talk about it, but that would go to my next point, and that's we have got to institute priority testing for long-term care providers.
Yeah, Maryland yesterday, Larry Hogan, governor of Maryland yesterday, announced that all residents of nursing homes and long-term care facilities would be tested. Now, that's expensive. We don't have a lot of tests. But is that what you're advocating here in Pennsylvania?
That's exactly right. I read today New Jersey is doubling their testing. You said Maryland is testing. West Virginia has mandated testing for long-term care providers. I know Massachusetts has brought in the National Guard to help with testing. It was announced 2 days ago that the city of Los Angeles is providing free testing for all of their residents. I guess my question is, if they can do it, why can't we?
Well, then my question is, has this been a priority for the state?
Well, I think it clearly has not. And, yesterday in the state house, an amendment was passed to a bill that basically required the governor, his administration, and the Department of Health to come up with a plan for testing, not get the test, not obtain the test, but just come up with a plan. How are we going to test folks? We were very thankful that included in that amendment and included in the requirements for this plan, long-term care providers, workers, and residents would be a priority in that testing.
Zach, just a personal note. And my mother passed away in early January and was living in a nursing home, suffering from Alzheimer's disease, and I can't help but think what the situation is like when there are wings of facilities that are separated from others for dementia and Alzheimer's patients. I mean, it's very difficult for those residents to understand what's going on anyway. How about now, where they're separated, and how can it be explained to them, or for them to understand what's going on?
Yeah, it's well. First of all, I my condolences to you and your family, and I can tell you, I mean, I'll share a personal note that my grandfather has dementia, is in a personal care home now outside of Philadelphia. And we are grappling with the same issue. And, you know, you ask, can it be explained? Can it be understood? For someone like my grandfather, it can. And, you know, I want to credit, I mean, I can talk about my personal experience, but I think it can extend statewide. I give credit to those staff members, those frontline workers who are doing this, who are trying to explain it, who are trying to keep residents safe. no matter what underlying condition they might have. You know, we're communicating with my grandfather at least once a week via FaceTime, via go-to meeting, whatever we use. And Scott, it's heartbreaking. But, you know, as I think I said to you a month ago, we know it's being done in his best interest and to keep him safe. And if we have to continue doing it that way, we'll keep doing it that way.
You mentioned staff. Are there enough staff members, people who are working in long-term care facilities, nursing homes?
Scott, I don't think there were enough staff in facilities before the epidemic started. And, you know, you could ask providers across the state about the staffing challenges that they faced a year ago, let alone right now. You know, you may have seen stories out of California where staff walked out of a nursing home for 2 days, or a story in southeastern Pennsylvania where the National Guard had to come in to help with staffing. And that's not hyperbole. That's the new reality for some. You know, the question is, how can providers keep staff now? I know that every provider that I've spoken with is paying hazard pay. They're doing wage increases of $5 to $15 an hour, bonuses, incentives, whatever it takes to keep staff in the facilities. And that's not just common. That's become mandatory in this environment. But, you know, one of the things that we're asking state government for, as well as the governor, is critical emergency funding. And that emergency funding would go to staff. And our fear is that very soon, if we're not able to allocate dollars to long-term care providers, providers are not going to be able to afford to continue paying those necessary bonuses and those necessary incentives to keep this workforce in the buildings and, frankly, to pay them what I think we all know they deserve.
Well, I want to touch on that a little bit more because, you know, even in normal circumstances, as you said, these workers worked hard, aren't making a lot of money. Turnover has been high because it is a stressful job, and they don't make a lot of money. Now, it's hard to even imagine what the stress is that they're going through. You know, I give them all the credit in the world because not making a lot of money and putting their lives on the line every day to go in and try to keep the residents safe. I mean, I guess the question is, and it's hard to tell, Zach, but will anything come out of this permanently in the way that these workers are looked upon and paid?
Well, I think we're seeing now, and it's a shame that it took this epidemic to put these workers in the spotlight, the frontline workers in our long-term care facilities, but they're heroes, and there's no other way to say it. And, you know, you asked the governor a few minutes ago, what are we going to learn from this? And moving forward, what's going to change? And when we talk about long-term care and we talk about nursing homes specifically, we're talking about a provider group, a part of the healthcare continuum that receives more than 70% of its reimbursement for the care provided by the Medicaid program. And that program has not been adequately funded for years. And what I'm hoping that we'll see as we realize the heroism that has taken place in our long-term care facilities, that there will be an emphasis put on long-term care moving forward. Long-term care providers and workers and residents, most importantly, will get the support that they need. And we will come out of this epidemic, which won't leave long-term care, Scott, for at least the next few months, but that we'll come out of this epidemic knowing that they deserve our gratitude and they deserve support from our state government.
So to summarize, Zach, if you were to ask today, what do you need to make sure that, maybe make sure is a little bit, saying this in a way that is too adamant, put it that way. But what has to happen to ensure that, I'm doing it again. Anyway, what has to happen going forward to keep residents safe and keep staff safe as well?
Yeah, you know, earlier this week, we at PHCA released a long-term care plan for Pennsylvania. And the things that we are asking for, critical emergency funding, critical priority testing for long-term care providers, workers, and residents, critical priority personal protective equipment, and really collaboration with state government. I think if we do those things, and Scott, we needed them yesterday, but if we implement them today, it will give providers and workers the tools that they need to be able to care for our most vulnerable. That's what we need to do right now.
Pennsylvania Healthcare Association President and CEO Zachary Schamberg. Zach, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Scott, thank you.
For more information on elder care, the coronavirus, a lot of other topics, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on Monday's Smart Talk, you may have heard about a report earlier this week that Pennsylvania school districts have already lost about $1 billion. We'll be talking about what that means this fall if classes indeed do reopen this fall. Pennsylvania's primary election has been pushed back to June 2nd due to the coronavirus pandemic. The question for many is whether voters can safely cast ballots in person. Democratic State Senator Wayne Fontana of Allegheny County has introduced a bill that would change Pennsylvania's voting system so that all elections are conducted entirely by mail. Senator Fontana joins us on the phone. Senator, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Scott. Great to be on the phone with you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Senator, tell me what your bill, what your proposal would do.
Well, first of all, Scott, I think it's important at this day and age with the pandemic for folks to understand that right now this bill is designed so folks can have a safe, healthy, and fair election, moving forward. That's now. That's, this year. Going after that, moving forward after that, I personally think we should be doing mail-in ballots regardless. But this particular bill, Senate Bill 1129, it says all elections held on or after November 1st, 2020, would be by mail-in ballot. The board would send by mail a prepaid postage official mail-in ballot to every qualified registered voter in their county. It would make it easy, right? It would be safe. It would be convenient. It would be cost-saving, and I honestly believe that it would give more citizens the opportunity to have their voice heard in the political system. So there's a lot more detail to it. It's patterned after Oregon's mail-in system, which has been in effect since 1999.
So just to clarify, this would not just be in response to the coronavirus pandemic. You're talking about right. This being permanent for Pennsylvania.
Exactly. I've had this in mind and put together for some time, actually. This is a conversation I had with our governor probably 6-8 months ago. And then when this started to happen, he certainly came out and endorsed mail-in voting. But I think it's something that we should be considering going forward. 5 states right now have mail-in ballots. 28 states do some portion or some partly do it partly. So it's been around and it's starting to take hold in a lot of other places.
Mm-hmm. President Trump addressed this. President Trump said that there is potential for fraud with mail-in balloting. Pew Research Center did a nationwide poll this week where the majority of people did support mail-in voting. I think was broken down along party lines. 87% of Democrats supported it, 49% of Republicans. That's not to say that all Republicans are thinking like President Trump, that it is something that is ripe for fraud. But what does that say to you? Still, you know, vast majority of Democrats, half Republicans do support this. What's it say to you politically?
Well, it certainly, to me, that statement was political in light of a presidential election coming. But the fact of the matter is, as I mentioned to you, mail-in ballots give folks, more folks, the opportunity to have their voice heard. So this is about increasing voter participation. And just from the stats that you mentioned, it shows that half Republicans that were polled don't want to increase this particular way of voting. Now, to throw out the and everyone does it, they throw out the fraud issue. Well, as I mentioned also earlier, Oregon's been doing it since 1999, and there's other states, including Utah, by the way, which is a Republican state, has been doing it. So it isn't like, you know, they said, oh, this is terrible, we're not going to do it anymore. They found a way to do it, and the fraud is very, very little, if any, in most of these cases. And it's, they have a way of doing it. And in my bill, it spells it out, how it's supposed to be done. In fact, I've had these conversations. I'm from Allegheny County, as you mentioned, from our county election folks. And they're, at first, everyone's a little reluctant at first till they get educated about how it works and that, and make sure that it's secure. And once they see that it is, I think people, you know, they begin to warm up to it. And that's what's happening here in Allegheny County. There is some warming up to it. In fact, they're sending the application directly with a pre-stamped envelope. And eventually they'd like to get to the point where they just send the ballot to, with a prepaid return envelope, to registered voters. So the other pushback was, oh, that some folks may not have the internet and be able to, you know, have register so they could get the ballot sent to them. What the county should be doing is just sending it direct to folks that are, you know, registered and qualified to vote. So the fraud issue is actually the verification of how someone or who votes is already in our election code. You know, it's done through the outer envelope for returns. It contains declarations to the voters. It's inside. There's qualifications and criteria that you have to, you know, show that it's the same person. So they know how to do it. You know, your birthday, your driver's license, your last four digits of Social Security, all that has to be verified for a voter to be able to vote or for them to count the votes. The other part of this also is obviously the timing. You can send, once you get your ballot, you can send it in. You can't start counting these ballots till 7 days before, but it gives you time to get it done. And you can't, you know, they're not, whoever's counting them can't say who's winning or that sort of thing. But all that's been done, all that's been secured, all that's been verified, you know, within the other states and how they do it. So we're not, you know, reinventing something here or just starting something. We know what works from what the other states are doing. And it's been successful.
Let's take a phone call from Bradley in York. Bradley, you're on the air. Hello, Bradley.
I hope I answered his question.
Well, I don't know, but let me just pass along. He said there was an election systems commission, a federal commission recently had a hearing available on YouTube discussing mail-in. Have you reviewed that, and are you aware of their recommendations?
No, I've not reviewed it. I'm happy if he wants to send it to me. I'll be happy to do that. We have, you know, got other, I guess, entities or commissions and that sort of thing from over the years that have said that, you know, it's something that the Heritage Foundation and some others have weighed in as far as, is there fraud, is this work or it doesn't work. So we have some studies that we've looked at, and they've all been showing, you know, positive results.
Why has this become a partisan issue. As I said, you know, most, okay, granted that Pew study found half of Republicans support it, half don't. But why has this become a partisan issue?
Well, I think it's been ongoing when you talk about ways to suppress the vote. You know, it's become a political matter. I mean, the more you give people the opportunity to vote, we feel, I guess Democrats feel, right or wrong, by the way, that, you know, it's better for the Democratic Party. The Republicans feel that it's not as good for the Republican Party to give more folks the opportunity to vote. I'm not sure why that is, to be honest with you. It seems to me that, you know, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, whether you like, you know, Senator Fontana or President Trump or not, you know, everybody has the opportunity to vote, whether you're Democrat, Republican, independent, nonpartisan, whatever it is. I have a tough time understanding that. But that seems to be the perception, is that, you know, this, if you have mail-in ballots, it increases the vote and it helps Democrats. If not, if we keep it the way it is, it's just a way to suppress the vote, less Democrats vote, so that gives the advantage to the Republicans. I'm not sure that's true, you know.
Senator, as you said, this is not revolutionary. Five other states do it. And actually, you named Utah, but from what I understand, three of those five states have a majority Republican you know, registrations in their states.
Right.
So it's not like it isn't happening in majority Republican states as well. But quite frankly, anything that changes how we vote here in Pennsylvania is revolutionary, because this, you know, getting this legislation passed that actually made it available to begin with, mail-in balloting, was something that was looked upon as revolutionary in this state. I mean, how do you get, and that took years to get done. So how do you get something like this done that is such a change from what we've done historically in Pennsylvania?
Well, I think it's going to have to come from the public, and you know, organizations out there. I had this conversation with my staff this week. It's, you know, I need help outside the legislature and to get this done, or it's not going to get done. And certainly you need the governor and the administration to want to do it. You need election bureaus around the state and the state of Pennsylvania also to buy in and understand that they're going to save a lot of money on machines and poll workers. That's the advantage to them. Again, it's about education. I need probably a lot of outside groups within Pennsylvania to help educate those folks that make these decisions and can make these decisions. The other way to do this is maybe county by county. I hate to do it that way, but that's another option. And then had just, you know, what counties see the value, they adopt it, and then, you know, others may go going forward. But, you know, it's one of those things where you need a groundswell, and you need an education groundswell and advocates to get it done.
Let's take a phone call from James. James, you're on the air.
Hello. My name, I'm a certified fraud examiner, and one thing I have seen before, and one thing I think will be measured out, is fraud occurs because people who want to commit the fraud find ways to be able to get in. Fraud seems to happen more often in traditional setups because it's been in place for a long period of time. Mail-in ballots would be new, and in my opinion, it would be more likely there'd be less fraud occurring because it is new. What do you think about that idea?
Senator?
I think it's obviously been proven already. You can't hack it, you know, because as you mentioned, the machines now, that's what part of the issue here was. That I know in Allegheny County, you know, being have to buy new machines and ones that can't be hacked. When you start thinking about that, you start to think, well, maybe we should just do mail-in ballots. The thing about this isn't just the envelopes. You can have tracking. You can have secure drop-offs. You certainly are going to have audits. And certainly harsh penalties to it. So I think. The other states, Oregon, Washington, Utah, Colorado, Hawaii, all these, they're doing it, you know, for a reason. They're not going to do it if they think it's going to be, you know, a problem or if there's going to be more fraud. So to the point it's made, there's other precautions, as I mentioned, the tracking and certainly the audits and those kinds of things, and a paper trail, by the way, which is something they always bring up about machines. Where's the paper trail in case it does get hacked? So this takes away all that, and I agree. I think this is and it's been proven. Again, these states are doing it, and there's little fraud.
Democratic State Senator Wayne Fontana of Allegheny County, thank you very much for being with us today.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Scott.
Coming up on Monday's show, we talk about schools losing money, $1 billion. That's Monday's program. Tune in.